We're being joined now by Bob Ferguson. Bob is a Republican Party treasurer, was not part of formulating this bill that we've been talking about, this House Bill 256, the Wyoming Sovereignty Act. But he wrote a letter to the committee that was to recommend or not recommend this to the rest of the House. Dear members of the committee, I am testifying today to encourage your support for House Bill 256, the Wyoming Sovereignty Act. This legislation has been desperately needed for quite some time due to the continuous intrusions by the federal government on the states. However, with the current administration's plans for massive federal government overreach, the time to act on this legislation is now, this session. As we all know, the federal government has ignored their enumerated powers and the Tenth Amendment almost since the adoption of the U.S. Constitution. However, the problem also arises due to the state's reluctance to challenge the federal government. This bill addresses that reluctance. Our system of government was fully intended to be a government of the states, with only some specific powers granted to the federal government, rather than being the overseer of everything in our daily lives. The enumerated powers of the federal government, spelled out in Article 1, Section 8, are very specific. Congress and the courts have frequently taken two clauses out of context to unconstitutionally expand their powers. Those are the Necessary and Proper Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, and the Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3. I will state both of these for the record, highlighting the very specific restrictions that were initially placed on those clauses. The Necessary and Proper Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18. The Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. And all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. As you can see from the specific wording, the Necessary and Proper Clause was to only be applied to those enumerated powers already stated in Section 8. This was absolutely not intended to give the federal government the ability to make any laws which they felt were necessary and proper. The ability for Congress to make laws only applies to the specific powers stated, such as borrowing money on the credit of the United States, coining money, providing for post offices, providing for a navy, etc., and nothing else. Our Constitution was written to be concise and easily understandable. However, when a section comes up for interpretation, one must turn to the Federalist Papers to read the actual discussion that was taking place at the time. During the ratification debates, anti-Federalists warned that the central government would abuse the clause to expand power. But supporters of the Constitution swore it would not. Based on what we see today, their fears were well-founded. However, the telling part of the intent of the clause can be found in the statements of the Federalists trying to allay the concerns about federal government overreach during the Constitutional Conventions. James Madison stated the intent of the clause by saying, in short, "This clause only enables them to carry into execution the powers given to them, but gives them no additional power. The sweeping clause, only extended to the enumerated powers, should Congress attempt to extend it to any power not enumerated, it would not be warranted by the clause." James Wilson from Pennsylvania went even further by stating that this clause is saying no more than that the powers we have already particularly given shall be effectually carried into execution. And Thomas McKeon insisted that it gives to Congress no further powers than those already enumerated. The Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3. United States Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states, and with the Indian tribes. Again, Congress and the courts have vastly expanded the definition of the Commerce Clause far beyond its original intent. The only commerce that the federal government has the authority to regulate is that 1, between nations, 2, among the states, and 3, with the Indian tribes. Once Congress passes laws that solely impact the residents within the state of Wyoming, they have exceeded their constitutional authority. If that commerce has nothing to do with the 3 stated exceptions, unfortunately, if states are unwilling to stand up for their own rights and sovereignty, then the overreach by the federal government will continue and expand. The original intent of the Commerce Clause can also be found in the Federalist Papers. In short, the Commerce Clause was intended to allow Congress the authority to help ensure that the nation operated, at least in some measure, as a uniformly well-tuned, harmonious commercial enterprise. It gave the federal government the ability to litigate issues between the states in order to encourage commerce rather than to stifle it. It was certainly not intended to give the federal government the right, for example, to tell a rancher what type of light bulbs he can use in his barn in Wyoming. The 10th Amendment to the Constitution is self-explanatory and is the proper answer to these overreaches. It states clearly and concisely, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited it to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. The state of Wyoming has every right and the ability to deny this massive overreach from the federal government. In closing, passage of House Bill 256 would be a massive boom to Wyoming in comparison to other states. We saw just how quickly the nationwide economy expanded when our last president was willing to shut down federal restrictions on businesses. Wyoming would receive an even greater boom to our economy if we were to appropriately nullify federal acts and agencies that impact commerce within the state. I, therefore, strongly urge you to support House Bill 256. I would be happy to answer any questions you might have. Bob Ferguson, Treasurer, Wyoming State Republican Party. But I just wanted to give Bob an opportunity to address any of you and maybe elaborate on some of the things that he said in there. First of all, welcome, Bob. We're glad to have you.
Thank you. Happy to be here. Happy to join you. And I thank you and Marty Halverson for all the work that you guys do as well.
It's a labor of love, I can assure you that. Diane is here with us at this point. The other two have gone home for the day, but will be participating again shortly. I watch what's happening in D.C. with the destruction of the Constitution. Voting laws don't mean anything. Gun laws don't mean anything. All of these rights that we hold self-evident are just being trampled and overshod. And it seems to me that nobody's standing up and saying, that's enough of this. And this was an opportunity for us to do that in what's supposed to be the most conservative state in the union. And it's like pulling teeth.
Well, not only was it an opportunity to stand up to the federal government for their overreach, but it was an opportunity for the legislators in Wyoming to actually abide by their oath. I mean, you know, the thing that I find, unfortunately, the bill did not pass out of committee because nobody in the committee recommended it to or motioned it forward. But the thing is, every single one of those legislators takes an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution and the Wyoming Constitution. What this bill basically did was it put in place the means to do that, the means to actually uphold the U.S. Constitution. And for all of those legislators to ignore that and not take the opportunity to put this committee in place that this bill would have created, I think is a gross dereliction of their duties as a legislature.
I wholeheartedly agree. I was livid after watching a thing that nobody even had the courage to stand up and just say, hey, let's have an open discussion of this out on the House floor. Let's look at this. This is their first order of responsibility, it should be. And yet they didn't have enough time. They were too busy doing other things. When given an opportunity to ask questions, we got inane questions like, well, who decided there should be 6 and 6?
Yeah.
Other.
Well, and then
it just showed me that there was no real interest in this.
Right. And then you had one of the members of the committee. I can't recall exactly who it was, but really focused in on that this bill was essentially created or constructed by members of the Republican Party.
That was McGuire.
Thank you for that. He made it very clear that he was from Natrona County and was on the Central Committee there. And that Natrona County, made a big point were people from Natrona and Laramie County invited to participate. So glad that Marty Halvorsen chimed in and said, yes, in fact, they were invited to participate, and they chose not to.
Yes.
Which is kind of the tack that that I've seen from representatives from Natrona and Laramie County at State Central Committee meetings. So you're right. A lot of the questions, one of the questions, another inane question, I think, Shelley Duncan asked the question, if Bob considered the Constitution a living, breathing document. I really wish that I had been there testifying I would have asked her to pick a section in the Constitution that refers to it as a living, breathing document. Those words are only ever uttered by people that want to change the Constitution outside of the amendment process.
How much of this came up in discussion with Marty, how much of this do you think the LSO might have had a bearing on this committee's attitude before this even came out?
Right. Well, and it's my understanding, I wasn't involved in any of the discussions with the LSO, but it's my understanding that they really panned the bill kind of wholeheartedly. But the thing is, I think, and in all honesty, I appreciated Representative Worf's testimony, but in all honesty, I think it might have gotten into the weeds a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think if you frame this as, Wyoming is a sovereign state, we already have rights to enforce, everything under our Constitution here within our borders. What this does is this only sets up a committee in the legislature for members of the legislature, both the Senate and the House, to look at things that, might be unconstitutional and then bring them forth to the legislature for discussion.
Certainly.
So if they're that afraid of having discussion about something that somebody in Wyoming thinks might be unconstitutional, then, I'm sorry, we've got a lot of work to do in ridding our legislature of representatives like that.
The objection to that was, where are we going to get these people who are expert enough to decide that something is against the Constitution?
Right.
Well, in part, that's what the LSO is for, but they seem to be a little bent on their own direction, from what I'm seeing.
Yeah. The interesting point about that is, I don't care how many people you have that are supposed experts on the Constitution, rulings get overturned all the time. I mean, Supreme Court precedent is not chiseled in stone for all eternity. Supreme Court precedents get overturned all the time. And, they're supposed to be the arbiters of, deciphering what the Constitution says and what it doesn't. But it's exactly the point that I made in my testimony that, this legislation has been needed for quite some time, because part of the problem rises in the state's reluctance to challenge the federal government.
Right.
And that is exactly what this bill addressed.
That was what I saw reflected in the hearts of the committee as I saw it, was they simply didn't want to take the risk of possibly being wrong or being perceived as wrong. The Constitution's not that hard to understand. It's pretty cut and dry. It's pretty simple.
Exactly. I mean, it was clearly written to really make sure that people could in fact, understand it and decipher it. I mean, you know, we see bills today that are, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of pages long for one single bill. I mean, if those guys had been in charge of writing the Constitution, we would not have a country
today. Yeah.
I mean, if politicians in Washington had that responsibility, they would fail in the task.
Well, your citing of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 19 and the necessary and proper, I thought was very insightful and poignant. I appreciate that. Also, the Commerce Clause and the abuse that has seen ad infinitum for many years. The whole concept of a minimal federal government has been lost for so long. And even at the state level, that a lot of the things that we talk about, we just had a little discussion earlier about, we go to Cheyenne as lawmakers. Well, assuming that I am able to win this next election and go to Cheyenne, I don't actually plan to go to as a lawmaker. We need to get rid of a bunch of this. Most of the stuff that we are addressing that takes up all the time, so we don't have time to talk about this issue, is stuff that governments have no business doing in the first place. It ought to be left to the private sector.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Totally correct. And, I can go into, the necessary and proper clause and how that's been unconstitutionally expanded. And it's not just by Congress, it's by the courts, too. The federal court system, by definition, is going to lean towards federalism. And, so a lot of the rulings that we've had over the years have really, almost just granted powers out of thin air to Congress that they never have. Never were granted in the first place. I mean, the Necessary and Proper Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, Congress shall have the power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. Mm-hmm. And all other powers vested by the Constitution in the government of the United States or any department or officer thereof. Clause 18, I think in my original letter I said it was 19, but I miscounted the paragraphs.
Okay,
but,
point taken.
There are all these other enumerated powers, like, to coin money, to borrow money with the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, to raise the Navy, to supply post offices, all very, very large, broad things that gives Congress the ability to do. But this clause, this last clause, specifically says Congress can make all laws necessary just to carry into execution the powers that we just stated.
Correct.
I read a very interesting essay that, you could have taken every single one of those enumerated powers and just stated afterwards, Congress can make all laws necessary to executing this power. And it would have been the exact same thing. Instead, they put in Clause 18, but it just referred to those enumerated powers. And, never was there supposed to be any intention to give the federal government to make any and all laws that, they felt were necessary and proper at any point in time. I think one of the things that I put in my final testimony was when you go back and look at the Federalist Papers in order to figure out what the founders were actually talking about, you had a lot of Federalists like James Madison in particular, James Wilson from Pennsylvania, that were really pushing federalism, and this clause got a lot of pushback specifically because people were concerned, that the federal government would use this clause to expand its power. But the Federalists actually, in their quotes, said, oh, no, that's not what's going to happen. That's not the intention of this clause at all. I mean, they specifically answered what Congress and the courts have done, specifically said, that's not what this clause is for. Madison specifically said, this clause only enables them to carry into execution the powers given to them, but it gives them no additional power. The sweeping clause only extended to the enumerated powers. Should Congress attempt to extend its power, is to extend any power not enumerated, it would not be warranted by this clause. Now, that's as black and white as it gets.
It ought to be, yeah.
Well, I have a question for you, just to clear up some terms, because you're talking about the Federalists, and I've heard references to needing to get back to federalism and the proper interpretation of the Constitution and that kind of thing. And then just a little bit ago, you said that the federal courts, by definition, would tend toward federalism. And I don't think those two things meant the same thing.
No, good, excellent point. Now, when I refer to the Federalists, plural, during the Constitutional Conventions, you know, there were basically two sides. There were the Federalists who were pushing a much stronger federal government, and then there were the Anti-Federalists, which were pushing for a, you know, much more limited federal government. You know, in the case of talking about the, you know, the Supreme Court in particular and federal courts, they have tended to expand those powers of federalism, you know, and really, really sort of stand in the corner of those pushing for a much stronger federal government. But the Federalists in the Constitutional Conventions were still only supporting a very limited role for the federal government.
Right. We appreciate you clearing that up. One of our goals here in the Ramble Room, we have a lot of people who are not particularly experienced at politics and how things work. And we don't like to take for granted that people just understand how things work and what the terms mean. So we are educational in that basis. So we appreciate you doing a great job with that. Obviously, you've done some homework.
Yeah. And like if you followed the signing of the Declaration of Independence, James Wilson from Pennsylvania was kind of one of the key swing votes for that state. Well, he was also at constitutional conventions and in the one in North Carolina, and he referred to this clause by saying this clause is saying no more than that the powers we have already particularly given shall be effectively carried into execution. So these are guys that were actually supporting a stronger federal government. But when it came time to answer for this clause, every single one of them said, absolutely, unequivocally, this does not give Congress the power to make any laws that they want to.
Right. Well, how we have wandered away from the tree.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And the thing is, it's been used. You know, you get a lot of the members of the Senate and the House are lawyers, and they obviously studied law. They took the bar. But somewhere along the way, they forgot to learn how to read, because a lot of them literally refer to use the Necessary and Proper Clause and the Commerce Clause as reasons to expand their power. The Necessary and Proper Clause is very interesting. One of the most recent uses in the Supreme Court was actually in the fight over Obamacare. And the federal, you know, the Obama's Justice Department was making the point that the individual mandate was necessary and proper because of the Necessary and Proper Clause, that the individual mandate was necessary and proper to this legislation. And believe it or not, Justice Roberts, even though he did still uphold Obamacare in a different decision, when it came to striking down the individual mandate, he upheld that the Necessary and Proper Clause was not applicable to that legislation, and that while something like the individual mandate that could be a key point to legislation, that the Necessary and Proper Clause didn't apply because it wasn't referring to, you know, the original enumerated power. So trying to make to the committee was regarding the Commerce Clause, because they put up the Commerce Clause as, you know, really a crutch for the federal government to regulate everything. Right. And, you know, I put later in my testimony, I mean, the Commerce Clause was never intended to give the federal government the right, for example, to tell a rancher what kind of light bulbs he can use in his barn in Wyoming. But they used the Commerce Clause to, you know, ban the use of incandescent light bulbs. The Commerce Clause was actually one of those clauses that, believe it or not, really wasn't heavily debated in the constitutional conventions. There was very little discussion of it because it wasn't intended to be this major overreaching clause. Basically, what it said was that the whole purpose of the clause was intended to allow Congress the authority to help ensure the nation operated as uniformly in commercial enterprise, mm-hmm. and that it gave the government the ability to litigate between the states in order to encourage commerce. Well, the Commerce Clause has been completely flipped on its ear, because what the federal government does is they use the Commerce Clause to ban commerce and put regulations and restrictions on every type of commerce to discourage commerce.
Case in point, the XL pipeline, for example.
Exactly. Perfect example. The way the XL pipeline, if you actually followed the Commerce Clause, the way the XL pipeline should have been used was, if the pipeline was supposed to go through 8 states and you had one state that was saying, no, we're not going to allow it to go through our state. Well, the federal government was supposed to have the ability to step in and say, well, because of the Commerce Clause, Congress is allowed to regulate commerce with foreign nations, among the states, and with the Indian tribes. This pipeline goes through the states, so we're going to litigate that this one state can't essentially put up a roadblock to this thing that helps all the states. That would be the application of the Commerce Clause as it was intended. But federal government is saying, you get the Biden administration saying, oh, well, we don't like oil and gas, so despite the fact that there are a dozen pipelines already, through these areas bringing oil and gas, we're going to say no to this one because we just don't like oil and gas. Never in a million years was Commerce Clause intended to do something like that.
Well said.
The Second Amendment Protection Act at least passed 5-0 out of committee, which, to tell you the truth, surprised me. I honestly thought, with the pushback from various police agencies around the state, that bill might face a lot more pushback. But it looks like it's proceeding. So, I've got my fingers crossed. I think we all need to focus on contacting our legislators and saying, with the current makeup of Congress, or the Senate and the House, I mean, the House is going to pass H.R. 127, which is a, quote-unquote, assault weapons and magazine ban.
Right.
It basically creates federal gun registry for every single firearm. They've already passed 2 background check bills out of the House, which most people don't really understand what they do, but one of them can essentially put a roadblock up indefinitely for anybody getting a gun. But it creates a federal registry for all guns. It would basically make, any AR-15 or other semi-automatic rifle an NFA item that you'd have to pay a $200 tax stamp and register with the NFA. And right now they've got a 10-month waiting list mm-hmm. on their own.
And that's actually the point of it. We did a show on that very bill, and it was interesting to me that one of the conclusions we came up with was they're putting up all of this red tape in order to ever let anyone get through it. These things would just all be clogged up and stopped, and then they get their registry, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll see that the anti-gunners don't try to eat the elephant all at once. Mm-hmm. They try to take smaller bites, to make things so unbelievably difficult that it discourages gun ownership. I moved to Wyoming from the state of Connecticut, which is about as anti-gun as you can possibly get. And to be perfectly honest, one of the final straws that broke the camel's back for us was when they passed red flag laws in Connecticut. I had a pretty high profile because I was a Republican chair. I worked for the NRA for 3 years, and everybody knew that. So I kind of was walking around the state of Connecticut with a target on my back.
Indeed.
And, anybody that knew my name could have made up a story that, oh, I saw them in a parking lot, and I brandished my weapon and stuff like that. and they could have made up any story, complete lie, without any penalties at all, gone and gotten, this red flag law enacted. And, you know, the police would have come and taken every gun I owned and every round of ammunition that I had on the basis of totally false, one-sided testimony without giving me the ability to get it back.
No due process whatsoever.
And in Connecticut, if you have your guns taken and your permit taken, then they have instituted this thing called the Board of Firearms Permit Examiners that is the only avenue to get it back. So even if they took it based on false testimony, and even if a judge ruled it's completely false, this guy should be able to get his guns back, it would have that committee, that board, had a two-year waiting list. So even if, like, you know, 2 weeks later a judge had said, you know, this is all bogus, no problem at all, he should get his guns back, it would have still taken me 2 years. And that's what the state of Connecticut did over time. They just kept on and kept on and kept on using every tragedy in the book, saying, oh, well, we've got to have the ability to confiscate guns from dangerous people. And, you know, they've essentially, made your rights, in Connecticut to bear arms, just a right that can be exercised if they feel like it.
Right.
You know, it's really a mess. And, you know, that's what the Second Amendment Protection Act does. Is it really puts up a firewall between law enforcement and citizens. I think the police agencies that testified against that bill, I'll be honest with you, I think they were a little bit overly dramatic. I know one sheriff stated that, you know, well, my officers aren't going to want to enforce any law that takes anybody's guns away. Well, the fact of the matter is, what the bill states is that they can't uphold federal laws confiscating firearms. If there's a Wyoming law confiscating firearms that they're upholding, that wouldn't prevent them from enforcing that law at all. If somebody gets cited for a crime, on the citation, the officer has to list what statute is in question. You know, what statute has been broken? They got a list of, you know, you get a speeding ticket, they list it right there.
Yep.
You know, whatever statute you broke. Well, if the officer is confident enough that somebody's breaking a Wyoming statute, he's got to cite them and he's got to state what statute that is. Well, if that's in the Wyoming statutes, then that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But what this says is that they can't uphold federal statutes. I had recommended a potential change to this bill if it got a lot of pushback in saying that police departments would not be allowed to use any funding to support federal gun control laws. So that, you know, and let's face it, the ATF and the FBI aren't really heavily manned with, you know, million man forces that can go all through the state of Wyoming and other states to enforce all these laws. They usually have to call on local law enforcement to do so. So in my amendment or potential amendment to the bill, hopefully it's not necessary, but it would effectively say that, you know, an ATF agent walks into your county sheriff's office and says he wants to have a no-knock raid and he wants to use five of his officers. Well, the county sheriff sits there and says, well, I'm sorry, we've got a statute in Wyoming that I can't use any of my budget to help you.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, since I'm on the clock right now and you're in my office, you got to leave my office because I can't spend any time on the clock even talking to you. And about enforcing federal gun laws. I'm hoping that that's not necessary because I think the bill is good as it is. But, that would be an answer to the police departments that don't support the bill.
I do appreciate that. One of the things that Marty brought up, which is something else that I've touted, is we need to be very cautious about who we elect as sheriffs, know where they're coming from. Are they a constitutional person? Do they understand that they are the supreme law of the area? Or are they just another scarecrow?
And I mean, I can understand their perspective that that bill penalizes police officers and threatens them with getting fired and getting sued if they help enforce federal gun control laws. Well, that's right, it does. But you know, you gotta train your officers that, you know, the Wyoming certainly doesn't feel like they'd like to abide by federal gun control laws. And you know, all this does is it tells the sheriffs to be on the side of the people, not the side of the federal government.
Well, Wyoming's constitution in regard to guns is every bit as clear, if not more so, than the U.S. Constitution. And that's still the law of the land so far.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and most constitutions, or many state constitutions at least, you know, are stronger and more specific than the Second Amendment.
I need to wrap this up here shortly. Is there anything you'd care to add to the discussion, something that you haven't had an opportunity to express?
Now, the only thing that I would say is that, you know, any pushback on a bill that you know, essentially challenges the federal government shouldn't be looked at as a reach, because it's very clear within the 10th Amendment that the powers not delegated to the United States government by the Constitution, nor prohibited to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. This is a right we already have.
Right.
You know, the state of Wyoming has every single right and ability to defend its sovereignty. And, you know, it really ticks me off, and I'm planning on writing another letter to the legislators that were in that the Corporations Committee that refused to pass this bill through. It's like, if you can't support a bill that says Wyoming has the right to defend its sovereignty, and you can't support against unconstitutional overreach, then you shouldn't have taken an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution.
Precisely.
It's simple. I mean, you should not one of those legislators should have a problem with this bill because it merely puts into place a mechanism for them to uphold the oath they already took.
And even if you couldn't necessarily get behind it and say, I'm all for this, all we were asking for was a motion to bring this to a discussion. Let's take this out there. This is an important issue, especially to a lot of your constituents. Let us have a voice. And nobody had the courage to raise their hand and make a motion and say, we need to listen to this.
Yeah, well, which unfortunately goes to the makeup of those committees. And there are several committees that are like this that unfortunately, you know, can... things that support conservative ideals don't get passed out of committee because the committees are basically jammed with a bunch of rhinos that, you know,
right,
are in favor of
and leadership
control.
Leadership handpicks what committees, because of who's in there, are going to listen to certain things. There's a lot of cleaning up that we need to do in Cheyenne. There are a lot of people out here in the streets working their jobs, raising their kids, going about their day-to-day life, that basically blindly trust legislators who call themselves conservatives to go to Cheyenne and to represent them and to do a good job. And we need to help make them aware of the fact that there are a large portion of them who just flat aren't doing that.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And, you know, we need to hold legislators accountable. And every single time, you know, a legislator is on a committee, I mean, usually the things that are public are just their votes once something gets out of committee. But, you know, if a legislator is on a committee and they vote to not pass through a pro-life bill or, you know, a pro-rights bill, you know, in any shape or form, then, you know, that ought to be front and center the next time they run for election. You know, that legislator needs to really be on the chopping block for that. You know, I'm in Park County, and our House representative was Sandy Newsom.
Yeah.
And you know, I gave Sandy Newsom, I didn't run against her, but you know, I gave her a lot of hard time on the radio and in things that I wrote for the paper on bills that, you know, are conservative bills that she didn't vote for, like voter ID, for example, or preventing sanctuary. And, you know, she had an explanation for all those, but, you know, basically said she supports them. You know, once she goes back around to running for it again, she said she supports them. Well, she also came to our central committee and was asked the question, you know, do you support hate crime legislation? And she said, no, absolutely not. I do not support hate crime legislation. Well, the bill that we just had up, I can't remember the number of the bill offhand, but it was, you know, the hate crime legislation bill personified, and she co-sponsored it. So the next time she's around, she's up for election, I'm going to make sure everybody in Park County knows that she said 2 months earlier that she wouldn't support hate crime legislation and then co-sponsored a bill to do exactly that.
We're working on trying to form a rally for here in the Sheridan area, and probably would be necessary to take it to other places as well. And Bob, I got to tell you, you're on my short list of people to speak at that. Nina Weber and I, by the way, have been friends for 20-some years, and I was disappointed that she was not able to defeat Sandy Newsom. Same thing here with Mark Kinnear. I've got him recorded standing up and talking about how he's 100% pro-gun, how he's 100% fiscal conservative. I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, what they say and what they do, unfortunately, have a tendency to be totally different things. And, you know, and I understand there are specific provisions in all bills that people may like or they may not like. You know, people may not like the Second Amendment Protection Act because it threatens police officers with getting fired or getting sued. You know, I support our police officers, and I you know, want them to have every opportunity to perform their duties. But when their duties extend over a certain point, you know, I got to draw the line and say, that's one you can't uphold.
No, very good point. Any other final comments?
No, that does it for me.
Well, thank you, Bob. I look forward to getting to know you a little bit better. We have a lot of things in common, and I think that we can help each other out and basically help the Wyoming people understand who it is that they're sending to Cheyenne.
Sounds good.
Thank you for being with
us. Anytime. God bless.